Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we open our show with some national news headlines from Public News Service, including an update on the federal budget, the aftermath of bombing Iran's nuclear facilities, RFK's latest actions on vaccines, and more. Then we'll have a report on two Supreme Court rulings, one allowing deportations of immigrants to countries that are not their homelands without due process. The other prohibits a nationwide injunction on Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. As our nation prepares to commemorate Independence Day, both of these rulings are drawing criticism for taking away constitutional rights. Also raising controversy is the deployment by President Trump of Marines to the border in the rural East County community of Campo. There is good news this week for recreational users at local lakes after San Diego City Council overrode a mayoral veto to keep the lakes open. Hear more on the final budget decisions on our show today. On Crime Beat, arrests have been made for the attempted murder of a teenager at Parkway Plaza in El Cajon. Plus, the sheriff reports that fentanyl deaths have dropped by 30% countywide. Find out why on today's show. East County Magazine has picked up two more journalism awards from the Society of Professional Journalists. On the second half of our show today, we'll have an interview with Chris Berg from the City of El Cajon on some major changes coming to downtown El Cajon, including bringing in new partners who helped revitalize Little Italy. The County Water Authority has voted to eliminate its funding of the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College in Rancho San Diego, putting the future of public access at the garden at risk. And finally, on Destination East County, we'll have a roundup of local 4th of July festivities and fireworks shows. And finally, CAL FIRE asks that we remind everyone that private use of fireworks is illegal across San Diego due to fire danger. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think everyone in the House, they know the peril they're in if they vote no on this thing.
Texas Congressman Michael McCaul says President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill is great, but also warns fellow Republicans their jobs depend on its success. Senate Republicans narrowly voted to start debate on the mega bill Saturday evening. Tennessee's Rand Paul voted no over raising the debt limit by $5 trillion, and North Carolina's Tom Tillis said he won't support cutting $40 trillion for Medicaid in his state. Tillis said Sunday he won't seek re-election. Democrats say Majority Leader John Thune broke Senate rules. They say after promising not to, he ignored a parliamentarians ruling that the Medicaid and SNAP cuts to pay for the tax cuts for the wealthy are subject to filibuster. And Virginia's Mark Warner says they're massively unpopular.
It's not over till it's over. I will grant that President Trump has been able to hold his party in line in an unprecedented manner. At the other end, this bill will come back and bite them.
Trump is demanding he get to sign the bill on the 4th of July, but hurdles remain in both closely divided chambers. House Democrats say they're not satisfied with administration explanations for bombing three nuclear sites in Iran. The extent of the damage is still being debated, and UN nuclear watchdog Rafael Grossi says he thinks Tehran could restart enriching uranium in a matter of months, not decades, as Trump has said. A Supreme Court ruling on presidential power will let Trump's ban on citizenship for babies with foreign-born parents go into effect, but only in states that failed to sue over it. California Attorney General Rob Bonta did sue and says he expects to win.
I'm hopeful that the court will see that a patchwork of state injunctions where birthright citizenship stands for some states but not others would inevitably create administrative chaos and spur questions we don't have the answers to.
The court didn't overrule the standard view that the 14th Amendment grants citizenship to any child born on American soil, except for special cases like diplomats' kids. The court did limit federal courts' ability to block presidential orders. During confirmation, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said he wouldn't undermine vaccines, but last week he empowered agency advisors, including vaccination skeptics, to rewrite inoculation recommendations, even on shots used for years. Doctors say they're alarmed that the panel voted to withdraw support for many flu vaccines due to a debunked theory worry about the preservative, thimerosal. A three-part online training on how to run for office and govern well starts tonight. The Grassroots Democracy Program from the Western Organization of Resource Councils aims to increase effective political engagement in Western states, and Gwen LeCoult says they expect lots of questions.
Everything from, am I ready to run for office? How do I organize my campaign? To how do I govern? And how can I be an effective elected official?
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
What's something you can do once you're elected?
Hey, how are you? Well, they're two different.
The U.S. Supreme Court has narrowed the scope of nationwide injunctions by lower courts in a case that involves President Donald Trump's executive order to eliminate birthright citizenship. It's been widely accepted that the Constitution's 14th Amendment confers automatic citizenship to most people who are born in the United States. The 14th Amendment states that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. Multiple lower courts that issued injunctions found Trump's order to be unconstitutional. Despite this, the Supreme Court ruled in a 6-3 vote to prohibit nationwide injunctions by lower courts. The case has implications that go beyond the birthright citizenship case, since the ban on nationwide injunctions could apply to other issues. To comply with the ruling, the lower courts must narrow their rulings to only those states over which it has jurisdiction, not nationwide. The ruling allows Trump to enforce his executive order in other states not covered by lower court decisions, putting the future of babies born to undocumented parents in limbo. The court did not rule on the constitutionality of Trump's executive order, but will likely do so in the future when an appeal of lower court rulings finding the order unconstitutional reached the Supreme Court on appeal. Trump signed an executive order on his first day in office that would no longer automatically grant citizenship at birth to children of immigrants in the U.S. without legal status. His order applies to all such babies born after the date the order was issued, not retroactively, so it could not be applied to Trump's own children, some of whom were born to Trump's immigrant wives who were not yet citizens. California and 21 other states quickly sued the administration over the executive order, and federal judges in Washington State, Maryland, and Massachusetts temporarily blocked the executive order after it was issued. Several district court judges issued injunctions that tried to stop the order from being implemented, but the Trump administration argued that federal district court judges shouldn't be able to issue such wide injunctions. Trump told reporters at the White House that the ruling is an amazing decision, striking down the excessive use of nationwide injunctions to interfere with the normal functioning of the executive branch. Trump continued, "Thanks to this decision, we can now properly file to proceed with these numerous policies and those that have been wrongly enjoined on a nationwide basis, including birthright citizenship, ending sanctuary city funding, suspending refugee resettlement, freezing unnecessary funding, stopping federal taxpayers from paying for transgender surgeries, and numerous other priorities of the American people." Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote in the majority opinion, "When a court concludes that the executive branch has acted unlawfully, the answer is not for the court to exceed its power too." Barrett added that the lower courts shall move expeditiously to figure out how broad the injunctions are, and that it's possible that states involved in the litigation could still obtain broad injunctions. But in a blistering dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, "No right is safe in the new legal regime the court creates. Today, the threat is to birthright citizenship. Tomorrow, a different administration may try to seize firearms from law-abiding citizens or prevent people of certain faiths from gathering to worship," Sotomayor warned. In a separate dissenting opinion, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote that the court's decision was an existential threat to the rule of law. "The court has said that the executive order would technically go into effect in 30 days after the ruling, according to NBC. The 14th Amendment became part of the U.S. Constitution in 1868 after the Civil War, and it granted citizenship and freedoms outlined in the Bill of Rights to formerly enslaved people. The Trump administration contends that the 14th Amendment doesn't extend to immigrants who are in the country illegally, or even to immigrants whose presence is lawful but temporary, such as those here on work or student visas. California's Democratic leaders have been swift to denounce the ruling. Senator Alex Padilla said in a press release that the Supreme Court's ruling undermines equal justice under the law. The court's decision means that the constitutional protections now depend on which state you live in or whether you can afford to file a lawsuit. He said the attack on birthright citizenship stokes fear in immigrant communities, adding, "It also fails every American who looks to the court to serve as a check to ensure that the executive branch follows the law." California Senator Adam Schiff called the ruling a dark day for our democracy. In a post on X, California Attorney General Rob Bonta issued this statement: "The rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution belong to everyone in this country, not just those whose state attorneys general had the courage to stand up to this president's anti-democratic agenda." Bonta adds that the Supreme Court's ruling is creating administrative chaos for California and others and harm to countless families across our country. "The fight is far from over," he pledged, "and we will continue working to ensure this unlawful, anti-democratic executive order never has the chance to be implemented." Bonta co-led a multi-state coalition arguing that Trump's attempt to unilaterally end birthright citizenship violates the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, as well as Section 1401 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. San Diego's Democratic Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs posted on X, "The court tightened the rules on when a single judge can issue a nationwide injunction instead of deciding the fate of birthright citizenship. That's still a big problem." But Republican Congressman Daryl Issa posted on X, "The Trump resistance in robes has been exposed by a supermajority of the Supreme Court. Time for an end to the rogue rulings from activist liberal judges." Curtis Morrison, an immigration lawyer who was running against ISA, told East County Magazine that his law firm is in the process of onboarding a group lawsuit to challenge Trump's latest travel ban right now. "Before, I was telling impacted visa applicants that they could participate as plaintiffs or wait on the sidelines to see whether the courts enjoin the ban. Now," he says, "he is forced to advise them to take legal action. I just don't see the point of me filing a lawsuit with thousands of plaintiffs when they all have the same legal issue in common. And one plaintiff puts the issue before the court. It throws judicial efficiency out the window. But worse, for those who can't afford litigation, it throws access to justice out the window. And that's probably the true goal," Morrison adds. The Supreme Court did provide one key exception to its ban on nationwide injunctions, allowing them if a nationwide class action suit is filed. So, hours after the ruling came down, the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, and immigrant rights groups filed a class action lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's executive order restricting birthright citizenship on behalf of a proposed class of babies subject to the executive order and their parents. This new case seeks protection for all families in the country, filling the gaps that may be left by the existing litigation. Cody Wofsy, deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrant Rights Project and lead attorney on the case, says of the birthright citizenship ban, "Every court to have looked at this cruel order agrees that it is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court's decision did not remotely suggest otherwise, and we are fighting to make sure President Trump cannot trample on the citizenship rights of a single child." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, your network for social justice, this is John Tidwell.
The Supreme Court has allowed the Trump administration to restart the swift deportations of migrants to countries that aren't their homelands. The conservative majority also lifted a court order that required migrants to be given a chance to challenge their deportations, according to PBS. Immigration officials have put 8 people on a plane to South Sudan that was eventually diverted to U.S. Naval Base in Djibouti after U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy stepped in. Those migrants were convicted of serious crimes in the United States, but immigration officials said they weren't able to quickly return them to their home countries, but the ruling could apply to other deportees who are not criminals. This case comes amid a sweeping immigration crackdown by President Donald Trump's administration, which has promised to deport anyone who's living in the United States illegally. The Supreme Court action halted a court order from Murphy, who had ruled that migrants must be given a chance to argue that deportation to a third-party country would put them in danger, even if they've exhausted their legal appeals. In a separate case, 4 undocumented immigrants with deportation orders went to a federal court in Massachusetts, seeking to block their removal to a country not identified in those orders. Murphy temporarily barred the government from deporting them without providing a written notice to the immigrants and their lawyers, giving them at least 10 days and a meaningful opportunity to express their fear of removal and at least 15 days to seek to reopen their immigration proceedings if the government determines that they don't meet their criteria. After the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit declined to put Murphy's order on hold, the Trump administration's Solicitor General, John Sauer, argued before the Supreme Court that Murphy's orders were wreaking havoc on the third country removal process and disrupting sensitive diplomatic foreign policy and national security efforts. The Supreme Court granted the Trump administration's request and put Murphy's order on hold while the government's appeals moved forward. Homeland Security praised the Supreme Court's decision to support the Trump administration's efforts to remove what it describes as the worst of the worst. But in a 19-page dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by Justice Elena Kagan and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, wrote that the court's actions exposes thousands to the risk of torture or death. Sotomayor criticized her colleagues in the majority for stepping in to grant the government emergency relief from an order it has repeatedly defied, when it should have allowed the lower court judges to manage the high-stakes litigation with the care and attention it plainly requires. Trina Realmuto, executive director of the National Immigration Litigation Alliance, said that the ramifications of the Supreme Court's order will be horrifying, PBS reports. Immigration attorney Ian Sorello, who chairs the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium, shares that concern. He told CBS 8, ICE could technically just go straight to your house and pick you up and deport you. Sorello says that deportation to a third-party country usually requires an arrangement between the U.S. and receiving country, as well as due process for the individual being deported. CBS News reports that the Trump administration has reached Costa Rica, Panama, and Rwanda about accepting migrants who aren't their citizens. Sorello adds, "So putting these people in the dark and simply leaving them in a country that they are not familiar with, and especially if that country is undergoing some social upheaval, then it's really putting people's lives in danger." He warns that under this decision, migrants could face deportation to a third-party country on the same day they're notified, leaving them with little to no time to consult legal representation. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Juliet Sanders.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report from CalMatters, a nonpartisan and nonprofit news organization reporting on California issues and holding leaders accountable. Dozens of Marines are now assigned to a Border Patrol station in San Diego's East County as part of the Trump administration's military buildup on the border. Some Marines there told CalMatters that they are out in Campo patrolling the border twice a day. That's a change from how Marines have operated in Southern California since President Trump took office. Until now, Marines have been limited to a supporting role, adhering to the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which keeps the armed forces away from civilian law enforcement. But Trump has long hinted at using the armed forces in unprecedented ways at the border to deal with what he describes as an invasion. And recently, the Trump administration shifted immigration enforcement northward toward the interior of California. Border Patrol agents there have been seen chasing farm workers through strawberry fields in Oxnard and swarming workers in unmarked cars at bus stops in inner-city Los Angeles. The Marines have not disclosed detaining anyone in California. Active-duty Army soldiers patrolling the border in New Mexico earlier this month reported turning people over to immigration authorities there, a change that illustrated escalating immigration enforcement by military service members. A spokesperson for the Joint Task Force Southern Border, in charge of the operation, did not return a request for comment by CalMatters, which broke this story. Border Patrol agent Gerardo Gutierrez says the Marines are just staging there for the assistance along the border and gave no details. California officials and immigration experts do not have details either on what the Marines are doing at the border. Kevin Johnson, a UC Davis School of Law professor whose work focuses on immigration and civil rights, says it is not clear to me what instructions the Marines are being given with respect to engagement with people who are attempting to cross the border. In April, Trump declared a 60-foot-wide strip of federal land that runs the length of the entire border as a military installation, a status meant to allow troops to patrol the region in the same way they protect military bases. On a recent trip to the Border Patrol site in Campo, Cal Matters reporters observed Marines' olive-colored tents pitched atop hot asphalt with nearby water tanks for brushing teeth and washing, and plenty of meals ready to eat. Their camp is a couple of hundred yards from the start of the Pacific Coast Trail, a stone's throw from the U.S.-Mexico border in a remote location. Earlier this month, Governor Gavin Newsom clashed with Trump over the federalization of the National Guard in Los Angeles and deployment of U.S. Marines to subdue protesters, calling it an unmistakable step toward authoritarianism. Newsom sued the administration, but a panel of judges from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the president had followed the law, and the case is unfolding at a lower court. A spokesperson for Newsom in a written statement to CalMatters connected the Marines at Campo to the Trump administration, sending Border Patrol agents hundreds of miles inland. Diana Cross-Pelayo of Newsom's office said, "We believe in strong border security, but this campaign is not about security, it's about fear. Now it appears Marines are being forced to backfill these border slots," she continues. "This is not just mission creep, it's putting law enforcement, our soldiers, and the community in danger." The military presence in Campo, previously unreported, follows an earlier deployment of roughly 500 Marines from Camp Pendleton who had been positioned in the small coastal town of Imperial Beach and in an inland border area near Brownfield Airport in Otay Mesa, both in San Diego County. According to the Department of Defense, those troops are tasked with detection, monitoring, logistics, and transportation support along the border. Over the last three decades, the border has become one of the most militarized regions in the world, with stronger, more formidable, and taller border barriers and increased surveillance. Migrant deaths have also increased as people sought more dangerous routes in the U.S., the Mexican government reported last month. When he took office, Trump issued a series of executive orders, including a national emergency declaration, to achieve what he described as full operational control of the southern border. The orders directed the Department of Defense through U.S. Northern Command to bolster border enforcement through increased military involvement. Some legal experts say turning land along the border into a military installation may sidestep the Posse Comitatus Act, which typically bars federal armed forces from conducting domestic law enforcement. Johnson, the UC Davis law professor, says there is a concern that armed troops may use deadly force in situations and that people may be injured, adding that military forces don't have experience dealing with vulnerable migrants and it's not clear what training they've received. "It is like a ticking time bomb," Johnson warns, adding, "it's only a matter of time until we see something bad happen." This isn't the first time U.S. troops have been sent to the border. The Department of Defense has deployed troops to the border under both Republican and Democratic administrations for construction and surveillance. But until now, their role has been limited to conducting surveillance, repairing vehicles, and fortifying barriers. The latest wave of deployments brings the total number of military personnel supporting the Border Patrol's mission at the Mexico border to more than 10,000 troops, added to the approximately 2,500 who were already stationed along the entire length of the 2,000-mile international border.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Anglers and outdoor enthusiasts are celebrating after the San Diego City Council voted to keep the city's lakes and reservoirs open, overriding some of Mayor Todd Gloria's budget vetoes. The city voted 6-3 to adopt a $6 billion budget for fiscal year 2025/2026, partially rejecting Gloria's proposed cuts aimed at closing a $350 million deficit, one of the largest in city history. Among the mayor's line item vetoes restored by the city council are funds for recreation programs at city reservoirs, partial support for wildfire prevention, nearly $1 million in community grant funds for council members, and $450,000 for racial equity initiatives. Some cuts remain, however. The council did not fully restore funding for arts, culture, and community festival grants and accepted partial reductions to stormwater and fire rescue budgets. The lakes, including Lake Murray, Lake Miramar, Barrett Lake, and others, have been targeted for reduced hours or weekday closures, a move expected to save about $200,000. Those closures are now off the table. The budget battle centered on differing revenue projections. The council chose not to rely on $3 million in anticipated digital billboard revenue, and declined to reinstate a chief operating officer position that Gloria eliminated in February. El Cajon resident Rob McGargle, an avid fisherman and member of Friends of the San Diego Lakes, advocated to keep lakes open, including several reservoirs in East County. He says, "It was quite the ordeal. We believe only two council members understood the scope of the lakes program at first. By the end, seven were on board. We've won this round, but the fight's not over." The change came after thousands signed a petition started by Friends of San Diego Lakes asking the council to keep lakes accessible to the public daily. McGargle calls for a long-term funding policy for the lakes. "We need a plan so we're not doing this again next year," he says. Mayor Gloria warns the council's overrides could endanger the city's financial stability. In a statement, he says, they added tens of millions in new spending without a credible plan to pay for it. "I used my veto to restore balance, accepting what we can afford and rejecting what we can't." He adds, "If their assumptions don't hold, they'll be responsible for the fallout, mid-year cuts, layoffs, brownouts, and broken promises." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Juliet Sanders.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Juliet Sanders with a Crime Beat report. El Cajon police have arrested three men and a juvenile for attempting to kill a 17-year-old boy inside Spencer's at Parkway Plaza Regional Shopping Mall on June 24th. According to Lieutenant Will Guerin, one suspect pointed a handgun at the victim's head and appeared to pull the trigger. Fortunately, the weapon jammed and did not fire. All four suspects fled the scene. Detectives reviewed surveillance footage, which confirmed the assault and attempted murder. According to Lieutenant Guerin, the video clearly identified the suspects as 19-year-old Abraham Rodriguez, 24-year-old Isidro Vasquez, and 23-year-old Jermaine Taylor, along with a 16-year-old male juvenile. Detectives later found the suspects nearby. Three of them ran into an apartment complex, the fourth was found at a nearby business. All were taken into custody. A search of the juvenile's apartment led to the recovery of two handguns. One of the firearms matched the description of the weapon used in the assault and was found jammed with a chambered round, showing evidence indicating a failed discharge. The juvenile, who is currently on probation for prior firearm offenses, was booked into the San Diego County Juvenile Detention Facility on multiple felony charges, including attempted murder, conspiracy, and firearm offenses. Rodriguez, Vasquez, and Taylor were booked into the San Diego Central Jail for attempted murder and conspiracy. Rodriguez and Vasquez are both on probation for previous firearm-related offenses. The motive for the attack remains unknown at this time. The investigation is ongoing, and anyone with additional information is urged to contact the El Cajon Police Department at 619-579-3311. Alternatively, tips can be shared anonymously through the Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477 or online at sdcrimestoppers.org.
Deaths from fentanyl have dropped 30% across San Diego County in 2024 over the prior year. That coincides with a major increase in drug seizures, including 1.9 million fentanyl pills worth more than $20 million over the past 18 months, Sheriff Kelly Martinez announced. In a press conference, Sheriff Martinez said, "When children as young as 13 years old began dying from using the drug, we knew we needed to act with more urgency." She credits state and county funding for aiding law enforcement's crackdown on illegal fentanyl sales. The sheriff's office obtained $1 million in funding from the state in 2023 to combat fentanyl use, with help from State Senator Brian Jones. In 2024, supervisors provided $500,000 in funding for the sheriff's office to investigate fentanyl-related matters. Supervisor Joel Anderson introduced the measure to boost funding for the crackdowns. He says, "Just think about those pills not on our streets. These are drugs that if you use them once, you're addicted for life." Increased distribution of Narcan to combat overdoses has also contributed to reducing the number of fentanyl-related deaths in San Diego County. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
East County Magazine editor Miriam Raftery won two awards from Society for Professional Journalists in the 2025 San Diego SPJ Journalism Competition. In the series category for daily reporting and writing, Raftery took third place for her series on the Water Conservation Garden's growing pains. The series chronicled the garden's financial struggles, brief closure, and reopening, though financial challenges remain. Raftery also won third place in the opinion editorial category for her editorial published last July 4th, titled, As We Celebrate Independence Day, Our Democracy is at Risk. Several of the threats to our democratic system of government that she warned of have since come to pass via authoritarian actions rolled out by the Trump administration following the blueprint outlined in Project 2025. East County Magazine has won 149 journalism awards since its launch in 2008, providing independent, public interest news for San Diego's inland region.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is Chris Berg. Chris is the marketing and engagement manager for the City of El Cajon, and we're here to talk about some exciting changes coming to the city's downtown area. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, the city has long had a business improvement district with its downtown El Cajon business partners. And now you've said in your press release we got that downtown El Cajon is entering an exciting new chapter alongside a new partner, New City America. This is the group that revitalized Little Italy, among other things. So can you tell us a little bit about what prompted the change and what this is going to mean for El Cajon?
Yeah, so the Downtown Business Partners, it's been a board that's been running this PBID. And for people that don't understand necessarily what a PBID is, it's kind of like an HOA where the commercial property owners within a district will vote to impose a tax on themselves that is used specifically for reinvestment in that district. And mm-hmm. It's to primarily elevate property values, bring in new businesses, things like that. And, you know, El Cajon's budget has been very steady because there hasn't been really new development happening. So those tax dollars are based on the buildings that are there.
Right.
And for years, we had been wanting to have a professional management company that could come in. And it was just a struggle of like, well, how do we afford to bring them on when budgets aren't going up? And we started looking at a lot of the other bids and PBIDs and CBIDs that are all around the county. And it was quite evident that a lot of people, once they brought the professional management team in, all of a sudden more development came in, more grants came in, and they were really able to fund themselves that way.
Super.
So we had put out last year a request for a proposal for different management companies. And we had gotten a few different ones in that had applied, and New City definitely came out ahead on that. And it was early this year, I'm trying to remember the exact month, it was probably around March that we approved them coming on board. And they're the group that they run Little Italy. Everyone in San Diego knows the explosion that that neighborhood has had.
It's amazing.
it's pretty cool to see. I believe, you know, Marco had said when they took over, I don't want to get the numbers wrong, but the number of restaurants that have gone up, it's been insane. The amount of development and new housing and things that go there. And then more recently, they've taken over downtown Chula Vista. And so you're seeing a lot of improvements there. Oh, they've now signed on doing the ballpark district and East Village. So they have so much experience in this area, and they're very well connected with different grant opportunities, which is really important. I mean, that's really where we can get in more funding to do a lot of these cool projects that is going to bring in the development. And so then it can organically grow from there.
Yeah. And that's the grant component, I think, is super important because we're in an era when a lot of federal grant money is drying up, which means some of the state funds drying up as well that rely on that. So it's looking more to private foundations and corporations and other kinds of sources that, you know, the average person or city or nonprofit for that matter might not know about, but these big, a big entity like the one you're bringing in here, the New City America, they know where to look for the funding. So
yeah, they've got so many connections already in place. And so when these businesses have seen how well their investment or, their promotion in one district has worked, they're going to follow that reputation.
Yeah, it's not reinventing the wheel here. Mm-hmm. So you've unveiled a gorgeous new logo that we've got, and there's work underway, I know already, to beautify the public spaces for starters. Can you share a little bit of what's going on there?
Yeah, so the logo I'm really excited about, and it brings in a lot of the history of downtown. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different elements in there, mm-hmm. But also looking forward to some of the things that we're going to be doing. So when you look at the logo, you see the archways, the arcades, yeah. And that's very common of downtown El Cajon's architecture. It was mm-hmm. those arcades built out on the one side of the sidewalk that give you that shade from the sun, that natural barrier.
And it's historic. I mean, we should add some of your buildings down there date to the 1800s. So it really is the heart of the city and a lot of history and culture,
yeah.
Diversity in there. I mean, everything.
Well, we saw like a lot of the tile work that we have downtown as well. And so that tile that's on the main logo it's the imprint of the magnolias that are on the archway sign.
Beautiful.
And then Bird of Paradise, which is the feature now, because we're going to be doing so much greenscaping and just making, when we say we want to add life to downtown, it's not just people, but we're going to be greening it up as well.
Oh, I love that. So, as part of this, you're revamping a lot of the events, changing up some of the old ones and bringing in some new ones. You just launched Artival, which was to showcase local artists, among other things. Can you tell us a little bit about that event and how it went? And is this going to be an annual affair now?
Yeah, we definitely want to make this one annual. And what was great, we're looking at different events that can become revenue neutral or even generate revenue. District, and that this one certainly did that. The artists had their fees in and people were buying art and filling the restaurants. But what I thought was really amazing about bringing a new event like that to El Cajon, it got so much media attention. From what I have found and tallied up, there were 87 different news stories published in San Diego, which was great. And when we were walking down the street talking to people, there were so many people that weren't from El Cajon. They were all up and down that 8 corridor. We had Allied Gardens, Kensington, Talmadge, La Mesa. Mm-hmm. So it really brought a new group of people to come explore. And I heard over and over all these visitors going, I had no idea how cute it was down here. Because it's, the downtown El Cajon reputation of years ago was different.
So. I should mention that. When I started East County Magazine in 2008, I mean, El Cajon, it was a lot of boarded up storefronts. There was like the XXX bookstore down there.
Exactly.
It was a little bit seedy, and then even before all the new stuff that you're doing, they did start bringing in out they got rid of the bad stuff. I think every storefront has been occupied for years when I go down there now, or nearly everyone. It's diverse, multicultural. You've got Iraqi owned and Mexican owned and everything else. And they have it's just, they've added a lot of outdoor sidewalks, outdoor dining. I'm sure there's probably more to come, but it's really become a great place. And then they started, bringing in more and more of the outdoor festivals. Speaking of which, I understand there's some changes to two of your longtime events, the outdoor concerts and the car shows. Tell us about that so people know, where to go and which nights.
Yeah, so the car shows are still on Wednesday nights. Mm-hmm. And so those will go... I get my months here right, June and July, and then
it's short. I want to say that that's shorter. It used to run more months, so folks, if you want to get out and see the car shows, now's the time to do it.
Exactly, and Steve has done a really great job of curating some new theme nights as well, mm-hmm. Because a lot of what we were seeing, you know, it was the same themes that were played out. And so he's bringing in, you know, one of our goals is we want to bring in new audiences.
So like what? What are some of the new themes?
You know, I'm not that good of a car guy to know all right. different ones, but I know he has done, he's got, I believe he's got like a Subaru Knight, a Porsche Knight. Like he's going beyond what were just the classic cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, for those who are the car guys, that's on our Instagram page. So you can check out all mm-hmm. the different theme calendars there. But yeah, he's done a really nice job of also working with the businesses, because it's no secret there were complaints there, and I know you know, people were trying to dismiss that, but the businesses are the ones that pay for this event, so we do
right. They were concerned about the car shows taking up all the parking there and saying, why don't you just move it to Parker Plaza or something? So it sounds like you've come up with a compromise here where it's a couple months out of the year. But is it the same hours it's always been, or is that it's
same hours? Yeah, and I think we all wanted to keep it downtown because it's a cool event. But what, you know, mm-hmm. Steve has done a really great job explaining to that community, like, hey, we need to leave these open until the car show,
right.
for the business. And so, yeah, he's done a wonderful job. I've been.
And really Steve, what's Steve's last name?
Lordigan, Lordigayan. It's everybody okay. knows him as Charger Steve though.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Very good. So tell us about the changes in the concerts. You've moved it from Fridays to Thursday nights now. So that I understand so that it wouldn't interfere with businesses that also have their own live entertainment going on, a lot of them on Friday nights. So now you can get live entertainment actually more nights of the week in a sense.
Yeah, it's really helped out twofold. One is we're not taking away from businesses, you know, like Downtown Cafe does live music on Friday
yeah,
nights.
Fun.
But also anytime we can activate a space more often,
mm-hmm.
That again is helping bring that life in. It keeps more investment coming in. And so by having things like Car Show Wednesday and then the Music on Main now on Thursday and then Friday and Saturday are just naturally busy for restaurants and things. And so it's been a way of rather than putting an event on top of what would already be a busy night, we're spreading that out so that downtown area is more and more activated. Our police department has been awesome at working at, you know, keeping things clean and clear of encampments and things so that we mm-hmm. can celebrate the downtown, the promenade. It's beautiful when everybody's packed in there and the music's going. It's really a great spot.
It is gorgeous. We should mention El Cajon is the only city in East County that actually does have a homeless shelter. So if you're clearing homeless folks away, there is a place for them to go.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've got a great relationship with ECTLC, but then there's several others.
Yeah, East County Transitional Living Center and some other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. And a church with tiny homes and so forth. Let's see. Back to events for a moment. So some of the other favorites are still going to be around. America on Main, which celebrates the multicultural aspect of East County. The Haunt Fest on Main, which is really fun for Halloween, and Holiday Lights on Main. I should mention all of your events are open to the public. There's no charge for this, maybe for some of the rides or things. I have to say, I mean, El Cajon, one thing I really like about your city is that they host more community events than any other city in East County. I don't know, maybe it's the most in the county, but certainly the most out here in our inland region. And they're really fun, fun festive occasions. I understand you're planning to launch something called Market Nights coming up. Can you tell us what that would entail and what kind of timeline there is, what it's going to take to make that happen?
Yeah, that, well, I'll first say that's not an official out there yet, but it has been a dream I definitely wanted to have happen.
Yeah.
We're in the planning stages and looking for funding for that, because again, mm-hmm. we want to make sure that our investments
right.
are
so it would be a better. Farmer's market, but a lot more than that. Tell us what the vision
yeah, so
would
it's,
be.
It's really an evening out. You know, as you said, having community events that people can participate in and have that free entertainment downtown is a, mm-hmm. a big piece of it. And so, but we've also seen from the community that there's a demand to have a farmer's market. And so
yes.
when I looked at the past, El Cajon had one and it failed miserably. It was in the middle of the afternoon on the promenade.
Mm-hmm.
It gets warm out here. So
it does.
Or looking yeah. at is the potential of doing an evening one that would go oh. year round, and then having
nice
live bands, beer and wine garden, food trucks, and then a lot of communal seating. You know, as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. we've got such a diverse population in downtown El Cajon. And so to, you know, I think one of the real ways to bring that community together is through food and big communal tables where we all share a meal. So
That's a great
idea behind that. And hopefully we can get that kicked off in the next year.
Yeah. And it's really becoming an entertainment district too. You've got you managed to get a few years back, the East County Performing Arts Center that had been closed for a decade, you know, in need of expensive repairs. And they finally got that reopened. It's now the Magnolia and it's run by Live Nation, which is the largest concert promoter in the nation. That was quite a coup there when the city made that happen. And then they brought in the Courtyard Marriott, you know, just a block away. So it's really becoming kind of a happening place with people coming in from all over for these things. What else is coming to town? Any new restaurants, or I believe there's a brewery in the works, I've heard.
Yeah. Well, and to go back on what you said with the Magnolia, it has set up the perfect platform to bring in new dining experiences. Mm-hmm. Like, there's such a consumer group. There's 1,200 seats in that place that is filling on a regular basis now. And so one of our goals is we would love to have 10 new sit-down restaurants in the downtown area in the next 2 years.
That's great.
But as you mentioned, the brewery Creative Creature is back to El Cajon. They'll be right next to Main Street Donuts and Deli.
Nice. And you just recently, the Brazilian Steakhouse, Radizio Brazilian Steakhouse came in, which is fabulous.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot coming. And so, again, you know, the connections with the new city part as well of having so many restaurants in Little Italy and things, you know, working with some of those restaurateurs to see the potential out here. Obviously, it's much cheaper to rent the space. And the city's done such a great job of crafting the market to be ready by having things like the Magnolia and the Courtyard. And so we're ready to make success for any restaurateur that wants to come in.
Sounds fabulous. Is there anything else that you want to share that you want our audience to know about what's happening in downtown El Cajon?
I would say just keep your eyes out for the next couple of months. You're going to start seeing, we've got the new furniture on order, all the new planters that'll be coming in, re-landscaping the medians. Like, there's a lot of visual changes you're going to see to make it such a friendlier place. You know, this year we repealed the ban on walking your dog downtown. That was such an old city council thing. So we did our end of prohibition celebration.
So old that most of the council didn't know there was a ban. That was funny.
Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of changes just to make it a friendlier lifestyle place. And we're looking forward to a lot more people visiting.
Sounds great. Where can people go to get more information about what's happening in downtown El Cajon and the city's latest happenings?
So you can go to our website for the downtown is downtownelcajon.com. And then there's also any of our social media tags would be at DT El Cajon.
Great. And you can also check our calendar at eastcountymagazine.org. And there's often our articles in there in our arts and events section as well.
We appreciate it.
Folks, if you just tuned in, we have been speaking with Chris Berg, who is the new marketing and engagement manager for the city of El Cajon. And there's a lot new happening in downtown El Cajon. Chris, I just want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The fate of public access at the Water Conservation Garden in Rancho San Diego is in limbo after the San Diego County Water Authority voted to withdraw its funding and participation from the Water Conservation Authority, the operators who run the Water Conservation Garden. Along with further loss of backing earlier this year from the financially strapped city of San Diego, the garden now looks to lose a third of its funding. The garden is a 6-acre site focused on natural resource conservation and sustainability. It opened with a strong backing during an era of major drought issues in 1999. A demonstration site for WaterWise Landscaping that offers programming research across the county, the garden has been receiving support from SDCWA since 2001. The garden is governed by the Water Conservation Authority. Other partners include the Grossmont Cuyamaca Community College District, which owns the land, along with Otay Water District, Helix Water District, and Sweetwater Water Authority. Helix Water District General Manager Brian Olney, acting administrator of the Water Conservation Garden, said while the action is a setback, it's not the proverbial nail in the coffin. Olney says that the Joint Powers Authority for the Water Conservation Garden adopted a budget this year that assumes the JPA agencies will contribute to the operations, which cost around $472,000. Of the remaining members, Sweetwater Authority will contribute a maximum promised amount of $48,000, with other agencies, Helix and Otay Water Districts, filling in the gap. The college district does not provide funding, only use of its land. The garden itself is doing very well, thanks to the Director of Operations, Lauren Magnuson, Olney says. He adds, "We have about $420,000 in the bank, and we'll use some of that money in the coming year. But when you look at this long term, this probably gives us 18 to 24 months. We'll be looking to find new memberships." The garden, which turned 25 this year, has strong community support. More than 2,700 people signed a petition asking the County Water Authority to remain in the Water Conservation Authority. With a frugal budget of 3 full-time and 3 part-time employees, the garden is operated and maintained by 100 active volunteers organized into 25 teams. The garden has 2,346 paid memberships, and the group says that 15,000 people visited in the past year. Through the decades, 90,000 elementary and middle school students from across San Diego County have visited on school field trips. In April 2024, the Water Conservation Authority took over management of the garden from a now-defunct nonprofit called Friends of the Garden, which had drained the coffers of the facility amid pandemic-era challenges. The County Water Authority's Administrative and Finance Committee discussed two options: to withdraw, or to withdraw with a parting contribution of $150,000 over the next 2 years. After hearing from Olney, Magnuson and several longtime volunteers, along with two committee members from Sweetwater and Ramona Water Districts, put forth a third motion for the County Water Authority to remain in the Water Conservation Authority and continue its funding, but that idea failed. Then, committee members Frank Hilliker of Lakeside Water District and Neil Myers of Elevenhein Municipal Water District moved to withdraw with a final one-time funding input of $50,000. Otay Water District Director Steve Castaneda encouraged the committee to make a final contribution, praising the volunteers' efforts, saying, "These people can stretch a penny as wide as the Water Conservation Garden itself." The motion passed 6-4 to be carried over to the consent calendar before the full board in the afternoon. But at the County Water Authority's full 22-member board meeting later on, of which the City of San Diego has 40% of the weighted vote, the agency nixed the $50,000 contribution. In explaining why she couldn't move forward with helping the garden financially, Ishman Abdullahi, also a representative from the City of San Diego and chair of the Administration and Finance Committee, said while she understands the importance of the garden, she has greater concerns. "I think they do an amazing job with the education program and the outreach," she said, but added that her concern is funding programs when we ourselves are struggling with paying all our obligations. Magnuson, who has been working with the Water Conservation Garden for more than a decade, says while she is disappointed, she has assured the volunteers that the site will progress and move forward. "We're going to go into our planning session in July and look at our revenue streams, our partnerships and programs, and make up the difference without them," she told East County Magazine. Kim Hales and Suzanne Till, board members from the Padre Dam Municipal Water District, which at one time was a JPA member of the garden, spoke as residents but not as part of the Padre Dam, with Hales championing the garden and urging continued support from the County Water Authority. During discussions in the morning and afternoon, Kathleen Coates Hedberg, Helix Water District and Water Conservation Authority president, listed reasons why the Water Authority Board should keep its membership. "Although the County Water Authority ultimately voted to withdraw without funding," Hedberg said, "the JPA board will make every effort to find new partnerships to keep this valuable resource open for San Diego County. If adequate funding cannot be found, the Water Conservation Authority has the option to turn over control of the garden to the Grossmont-Cuyamaca Community College District. But if that happens, there is no guarantee how much public access would be preserved, since the college district's priority will be education of its students." The board also approved wholesale water rates for 2026, approving a recommended budget for the next 2 fiscal years. County Water Authority's wholesale water rate next year will increase to 8.3%, which Board Chair Nick Sereno, who is also Deputy Chief of Staff for City of San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria, said is less than half of what was forecasted in early 2025, when officials forecasted an 18% increase. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Juliet Sanders.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
As Independence Day approaches, Cal Fire wants to remind everyone that private use of fireworks is illegal countywide due to fire danger. Fortunately, there are many professional fireworks shows and other 4th of July events across our region. Our region's largest fireworks display is the Big Bay Boom at San Diego Bay, with fireworks launched off of 4 barges starting at 9 p.m. You can also view fireworks over Mission Bay, launched from SeaWorld, starting around 8:50 p.m. In East County, you can bring a picnic to Kennedy Park, which has train rides, crafts, and games starting at 3 p.m., with a DJ and fireworks at 9 p.m. Santee Salutes at Town Center Community Park in Santee has live music, kids' zone, and food vendors all afternoon, starting at 2 p.m., with a patriotic ceremony at 6 p.m. and fireworks at 9 p.m. In Ramona, Olive Pierce Middle School has activities starting at 4 p.m., including free painting, cornhole, food vendors, and a DJ, followed by fireworks set to music at 9 p.m. Julian hosts its annual 4th of July parade from 9 a.m. to noon down Main Street. The festivities also include live music, a pie-eating contest, and vintage airplane flyover, but no fireworks due to fire danger. Poway hosts its old-fashioned 4th of July festivities at Old Poway Park, with vintage games, crafts, model trains, vintage train rides, tasty treats, and more. Escondido's Independent Festival is at Grape Day Park and the California Center for the Arts, with live music and dancing all evening, plus artisan vendors, food trucks, a beer garden, kids' activities, and fireworks at 9 p.m. Rancho Bernardo's Spirit of the Fourth includes a parade starting at 3:30, as well as crafts, food booths, car show, children's activities, and more at Webb Park. There's a patriotic pet contest at 9:30 a.m., Veterans Memorial Service at 11:30, followed by music and entertainment in the evening hours. At 9 p.m., a fireworks show will be held at Rancho Bernardo High School. In the South Bay area, you can view fireworks at the Chula Vista Elite Athlete Center or at the Imperial Beach Pier, both at 9 p.m. The Imperial Beach Pier also has live music from 1 to 3 p.m. and again from 6 to 8 p.m. Coronado hosts an all-day celebration starting with a fun run at 7:30 a.m., followed by a 10 a.m. parade, a 4 p.m. concert, plus Navy leapfrogs, skydiving, and headliner entertainment with fireworks over Glorieta Bay at 9 p.m. You can also watch a fireworks spectacular at the San Diego County Fair in Del Mar starting at 9 p.m. or check out a drone show in patriotic formation over La Jolla Shores at 9 p.m. San Marcos's Red, White, and Boom extravaganza is at Bradley Park from 9 to 5 p.m. with live music, carnival games, food vendors, and fireworks. You can find details on all of these 4th of July festivities on our calendar at eastcountymagazine.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jewell, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.